Hello everyone, and welcome to the Friday Forum webinar. I am Marianne Stumbaugh, Assistant Director of Alumni Career Services here at the Alumni Association at UVA, and I'm glad you've joined us for this Friday Forum. I'd like to go over some administrative information first. Our presenter will take questions during his presentation, as well as at the end of the webinar, as time allows. You can type your questions into the chat box at the lower left of your screen at any time. After you type your question, be sure to hit enter in order for it to show up in the chat window. Rob will also do a poll during his webinar, and the polling button is the one with the A on it and to the right of the raise hand button. Today we welcome UVA alumnus Rob Biesenbach. Rob is a 1985 graduate of the university, where he majored in English and American government, was managing editor of the university journal, and had the honor of living on the lawn. Rob also had the honor of presenting our very first Friday Forum in October of 2011. Rob is a corporate communications expert. His former jobs include press secretary to a state attorney general and VP at a public relations firm. Rob is also an actor. He trained at Second City and has appeared in more than 150 stage and commercial productions. Also, Rob is an author. His books aim to bring together the business and acting worlds, as you will hear in his webinar. Now I have to admit, I'm a bit worried about committing a presentation sin, so I'll pass you on to Rob now. Here is Rob Biesenbach with Overcoming the 11 Deadly Sins of Public Speaking and Presentation.
All right, here we are. Thank you very much, Marianne. Thank you to all of you. It's always a pleasure to spend some time with some fellow Wahoos. And in fact, I dug deep in my closet and managed to find my old UVA tie, which hasn't seen the light of day for quite some time. Now, the reason we are here today is that somewhere in the world, right now, people are suffering. They are trapped in some windowless conference room or cavernous ballroom, stuck in a veritable hell on earth. And the instrument of their torture, PowerPoint. Researchers estimate that the average business person over the course of his or her career will spend the equivalent of 7 years in windowless conference rooms being put to sleep by really bad PowerPoint. Now, that's an exaggeration, of course. It'll only seem like 7 years because the truth is most people are not very good presenters and their sins are many. They ignore the needs and concerns of their audience. They fail to tell a compelling story. They bury us in facts and data without giving us a reason to care. Their visuals are dull and ugly, and their delivery is dry and listless. Now, that's the bad news. The good news is, in this sea of mediocrity, you have an opportunity to really stand out. If you adopt just a few of the tips I give you here today, you'll be well on your way to delivering more powerful presentations. And who knows, if you really work at it, someday you can get to the point where your colleagues will run, not walk, to conference room B just for the opportunity to see you perform. Now, it's no accident that I use the word perform. About 10 years ago, I started a second career as an actor, and as you can see here, I've played many illustrious roles. Playing that ink cartridge was an especially tricky makeup job. But what I learned was that the parallels between acting and business, there's so many of them. Both of them require you to connect with an audience, to tell your story, to express yourself in clear and compelling terms. See, I think that every speech and presentation should be treated like a performance. And if you adopt the proven techniques that actors use to make the most of that performance, you're going to be more successful. And a successful presentation can help you in countless ways in business and in life. They can help you win approval for a project or budget at work, sell a product or service to a customer, spread an idea, maybe even change the world. There's lots of opportunities out there. But first, you have to get past these 11 deadly sins. And your path to redemption goes through the world of performance. Now, I will also be, there will be some live tweeting going on. I've automated these tweets. Don't worry, I'm not tweeting as I speak. But if you're on Twitter and you want to chime in, the hashtag is DeadlyPrezSins. So first this. I first realized the real power of a speech to transform lives when I was working. My client was Navistar. I was working at Ogilvy PR back in the mid-1990s, and Navistar was our client, and they make trucks and engines, and they were going through a very hard time. They were getting beat up by the competition and beaten down by Wall Street, and employees were in near rebellion. But then along came a brand new CEO, and he vowed to turn the company's fortunes around. And as his communications team, one of the first things we did was gather together the company's top 450 leaders for 3 days. And they heard speeches and presentations about a new vision and strategy, new products in the pipeline, whole new ways of doing business. And the people there were truly transformed. We saw it in our data. Confidence in the company's direction and in the management went through the roof. But more than that, we got it from the testimony of the attendees. They came up and told us these things, and they wrote about them in their evaluations. They said, I had given up on this company, but now I'm going to get back in the fight. Sign me up. I'm ready to help make change happen. And one of them even said, I will buy stock, which was a really great indicator. And to me, again, that's what's at stake here. The power and ability of a speech to really impact people's confidence and their outlook and their lives. Now, I just wanted to check in. I assume you signed up for this webinar because you do some presenting or you think you're going to do some presenting. So I just wanted to make sure and see what kind of presentations you normally do or expect to do. Is it presenting around the office to colleagues? Is it industry groups, customers? Just fill in the chat window of whatever kind of presentations you do. And I may not be seeing the chat window, or maybe people are.
Rob, be sure to click on the room tab, not the moderators tab, in the chat box.
Yeah, I'm there.
Try scrolling down. We're getting lots of information. Try scrolling down.
Oh, scrolling down. There we go. All right. Thanks. I was way up and somebody joined an hour ago. Okay. Coworkers, industry groups, strangers, 3-hour workshops, exercise leader, budgets, business, clients, potential clients. All right. HR employees, marketing, colleagues. Okay. Classroom, academic. All right. Great. Thank you very much. I see a wide variety of speeches here. And that's the thing. It's hard to do a one-size-fits-all lesson for every possible kind of speech. So I'll be adding nuance here and there where I can to help fill out the different kinds of speeches. But generally, many of these lessons will apply to whatever kind of speaking you do. So let's jump right in. We've got 11 deadly sins to go through. And the first one is understanding your audience. And this is a key one, because if you don't know who you're talking to, then how can you possibly make an adequate connection with them? So, and this is also one of the first rules of show business, of course, is to know your audience. So you want to ask a few questions. First of all, you want to know who they are. And this seems obvious, of course. But if it's a small group that you're presenting to, you want to look them up on Google and LinkedIn and find out as much as possible about them. And if they're a larger group, if you're attending a big conference, you want to look over the attendees list. You want to talk to the organizer. You maybe even want to talk to some of the audience members in advance to gauge who they are and how they're feeling. You want to know what they want. It's inevitable whenever I sit down with an executive at the beginning of a speech, they say, okay, this is what I want to tell them, or this is what they need to know. And I always back up and say, well, first of all, let's talk about what they want. Because if we don't deliver on that, we're never going to get our point across. And finally, what is their mood? Critically important, because this will shape the tone of what you communicate. It's not just what you say, but how you say it. So are they anxious, frustrated, impatient, angry? Or are they energized, unified, happy, and raring to go? If you miss that, if your communication, if your speech is tone deaf, then you're going to fail right out of the gate. I think, you know, often I hear people when they talk about fear of public speaking, one of the things they say is they worry about having to get up in front of a bunch of strangers. But if you really do your homework and understand your audience, they might be less strangers and more like allies. And there are a lot more tips in the book. We're just touching on a few of them. There's a lot more you want to know about your audience, but those are some of the key ones. Flat opening. You want to start strong. In acting, apparently, when you go for an audition, the casting people make up their mind about you in the first 30 seconds. And you may get a little more leeway in the speech, but the honest truth is that your audience is judging you on all kinds of things, from the way you carry yourself, to what you're wearing, to the sound of your voice, to whether you remind them of their ex. So it really pays to start out strong and hit the ground running. Let's look at a few things not to do first. First of all, don't just start by walking us through your agenda. Anybody can do that. You want to captivate our interest before you're going to tell us what you're going to talk about. Don't start by selling. I went to a presentation where the first thing the guy did was he pulled out his book and walked us through it chapter by chapter, telling us how wonderful his book was and encouraging us all to buy it. And avoid cheerleader mode. This may work for a few rare people, but I think we've all been to one of those conferences. It's like 8 in the morning, you barely had your coffee, and somebody comes out and says, "Hey, how's everybody feeling this morning? Who's psyched for some learning? I can't hear you. What was that?" And they try to get you to join in and applaud, and it's very annoying. I hope we all agree on that. And some people are very good at this, but you have to be that kind of person and have the trust of your audience to pull that off. Otherwise, I don't recommend it. So what can you do? I like to start with a story. We're going to talk a lot about stories a couple of sins from now, but storytelling is a great way to kick things off, because when you're telling a story, you're describing a problem, and if you've done your research, it's a problem that the audience shares. So automatically, you're in their heads. The other great things about stories is they humanize you. They show a side that they might not otherwise see, or maybe a little vulnerability. There's something called the fish out of water tale, sometimes called a stranger in a strange land, and it's very endearing because everybody's felt at some point awkward and out of place. And so I did this a couple years ago. I went out to Denver. I'm right now in Chicago, East Coaster, not much of a Westerner. So I went out to Denver, and the weekend before I had gone skiing. And I told them, boy, I hadn't been skiing in 10 years. So I showed this picture and said, well, you can tell for yourself how my, you know, whether I was a little rusty after all that time. And then I riffed on the fact that the black diamonds in Keystone, Colorado were remarkably different than the ones I was accustomed to in Baraboo, Wisconsin. And they appreciated that because it shows a little humility. It shows an interest in their world. One of the easiest stories to tell, oh, and I didn't even advance that. That is a funny slide of the ski crash. All right. Now, one of the easiest stories to tell is the old, a funny thing happened to me on the way to the speech. You got stuck in traffic. The airline lost your luggage. You spilled coffee on your pants. These are not the kind of things that are going to make your audience like roll on the floor laughing, but there's a little true life moments that everyone can relate to. And they give you that knowing nod, like, oh yeah, I've been there. And sometimes that's a very simple way to start a speech. Now, there are also many other ways. You can cite a startling statistic. You can come out with an audacious claim. Many other ways to open a speech. And in fact, I'll talk a little later. I have a whole little publication, a guide that's free that can help you how to start your speech with a bang instead of a whimper. I'll talk about that in a few minutes. We've all had this experience where a speaker rambles on and on and on. And the problem is people try to pack too much in. And when you try to communicate everything, you end up communicating nothing. So it's especially important these days because the average time allotted for a speech is going down and down and down. It used to be like 60 minutes, and then it became 40, 45 minutes, and increasingly now it's around 20 minutes, especially with TED Talks infiltrating our culture. Those have an 18-minute limit. So in this shortened time span, it's all the more important that you really focus your content. So here are a few ideas on how to do that. First of all, you have to understand what your presentation is about. And think of this, that the presentation is just one way to get your point across. And this is where so many speakers slip up. They say, I got to tell them all this stuff. There are lots of ways to communicate. You can send information in advance. You can have a handout available during the speech. You can do a leave behind document. And there's a document that all of you will have, a handout that will outline this whole thing and give you some tips and links to resources. You can follow up by email, links to videos, all kinds of ways. So don't make everything dependent on this one event. Choose what you're going to say here and now. Here's a great tactic. It's a classic. It's no, feel, do. What do you want the audience to know, first of all? And the problem is most speeches begin and end with this. And if all you're doing is passing along information, it's a squandered opportunity. You can just send them a memo. You want to step it up at least two levels. You want them to feel something because that's the key to getting them to do something. You want them to feel inspired, chastened, warned, motivated, whatever it is, that's the key to the final thing of getting them to do whatever it is you want them to do. Maybe it's buy your product, implement your idea, invite you to a follow-up meeting, whatever it is. You want to hone in on just a few points, ideally three, maybe five, and repeat them over and over and over again. Now, this is, everybody wants a template. This is my magical unicorns and rainbow template. It won't serve every possible speech you do, but I think many of them it'll work. And again, going back to why you're here, very often if you have a short amount of time, you're not trying to educate them on everything you know. You want to point out a problem. You want to call their attention to a possible solution. You want to explain quickly in a few points what that solution is, why it's better than some others, and then you want to get them to do something. And usually what you want them to do is get intrigued enough so they will find out more. They want to find out more. Think of your speech not as an ending, but as a starting point to getting your audience more involved in the topic you're talking about. Now, as I said, storytelling is absolutely critical. It should be the centerpiece of any good presentation. And there's nothing more powerful than a story when it comes to moving and persuading audiences. And there's tons of science on this fact. And you can research it. I could go on for hours about storytelling. But let me tell you what a story is. It's very simple. A story is a character in pursuit of a goal in the face of some challenge or obstacle. And how that character deals with that challenge, how they resolve that obstacle, is where the human interest in drama lies. Let me give you an example. Classic of Western literature, Romeo and Juliet. Our characters are Romeo and Juliet. Their goal is to be together, and the obstacle they face is their families can't stand each other. Montagues and the Capulets just can't get along. Whether they resolve that obstacle is up to you and your own belief system. They certainly end up together in death, if not the afterlife, if you believe in happy endings. Here's a real-world example. A few years ago, I was working with a client. They manufacture candy and gum, and they wanted to demonstrate their commitment to quality. So we went out looking for stories, and I ended up talking to this woman on the line named Estella, and her job is she inspects the gum as it goes out the door, watches it go by the conveyor on the conveyor belt. And I asked her what she does to ensure quality. And she walked me through a process from start to finish, and she demonstrated the x-ray machine and showed me these checklists, and it was impressive, but it didn't really grab me. So I knew she had kids, and I said, boy, your kids must think you've got a really cool job. And she lit up. I said, oh yeah, they love me. I'm the candy lady. And she turned over one of the packages of gum and showed me this code on the bottom. And that code tells you exactly when and where the gum was made, right down to the individual shift or production line. And the thing is, her kids can read the code. So what do you think happens when they go to the store? The kids run straight to the candy aisle, turn over the packages of gum, find the right one, and say, this is mommy's gum. My mommy made this gum. Now that's a story. Here's a company you can count on for quality. It's good enough for your family because Estella is down there on the line every day making sure it's good enough for hers. This story works because it puts a face on an issue. It embodies it in a character that we can relate to, a mom looking out for her kids. And finally, it elevates everyday issues because we don't care about parts per million and production processes and lean enterprise and all that stuff. We care about love and safety and family and the well-being of children. And that's why this story grabs you. Going back again, our character here in this story is Estella. Her goal is quality. Her challenge was, how does she keep focused on quality in the face of what many of us would consider a rather mundane task of watching packages of gum go by all day? And she resolved that challenge by treating her customers like family. And you can use this structure to develop stories for your presentation. You want to think about your audience's major challenges and issues, or what are their goals. And then find characters who've overcome those challenges. It might be a character from history, a major public figure. It might be somebody within your company. It might be you, but better off, it might be one of them. If you've done your audience research, you might find everyday heroes out there among their peers who've overcome some of these challenges. Now, sin number five. This is a hard thing for many to grasp, especially left-brained people, but facts and reason are very often not the best way to get your point across. Facts are called cold and hard for a reason. They don't have the ability to warm your heart, which is the key to changing your mind. Put another way, Seth Godin is a master marketer and author of many books, and he said this, the market is not seduced by logic. People are moved by stories and drama and hints and clues and discovery. Logic is a battering ram. Now, speaking of logic, I'm sure all of you are on the same page with me here that we can't really discuss logic unless we discuss Star Trek, the original series. You probably already recognize the episode I'm going to talk about. This is Amok Time. And I'll just refresh you because you may not remember, but this is the episode where Spock is afflicted with something called Pon-Farr, which is sort of the Vulcan equivalent of spawning season. His hormones go into overdrive, goes a little crazy, hijacks the Enterprise, returns to his home planet, and fights his captain and best friend, James T. Kirk, in a battle to the death. He ends up killing Kirk, and it's very dramatic, and Spock, you know, regains his composure, and he goes back up at the Enterprise to turn himself in for court-martial, and surprise, surprise, who does he see but his old friend Kirk, and he, in a spontaneous outpouring of emotion, he turns around, he grabs Kirk by the shoulders and cries, Jim! And it's this moment that forever endears us to Spock, because he opens up that curtain and shows us that human side that we all know is there. Now, okay, Star Trek's a little silly, but this is something that's really important. People want to see that side of you. They want to see you express a little emotion, a little humanity. I've worked with executives who are very reluctant to do this, and I think that's part and parcel of leadership. People follow people, not programs and processes and logic. So you need to find a way to tap into that emotion. And I believe that everyone has an emotional reservoir somewhere. For some, it may be right on the surface. Others, you have to dig pretty deep. And again, in the 11 Deadly Sins book, there's a process for this. I will just top line it for you. A few things to think about. If you're talking about your career, don't just talk about what you do, but why you do it. Who do you help? What's the big picture? What's the higher purpose? Or talk about your passions and interests outside of work. What really gets you going? And what is it about those activities that's so important and that makes you feel the way you do? And how can that relate back to your work? And finally, don't be afraid to get personal. Get to the heart of the matter. I saw with Estella down on the line, I asked her about quality. She showed me processes. And I asked her about family. That's when she opened up and told me a great story, and her face lit up. So again, if you're uncomfortable with this emotional thing, if you're more Spock than Kirk, I suggest you work on it. It's part of being a leader. Now, well, let's take a few questions here. Right now, we're about midway through the sins, and I'm happy to answer a few questions before we move on. And maybe some people have already recorded questions that Marianne is aware of. I'm happy to answer those as well. And I'll take a sip of water. This, by the way, is how you take a sip of water. Not like this. That was a bonus lesson for you. And if we don't do questions right now, I am totally happy to drive right along. Do you have a favorite website for pictures? I absolutely do. And in fact, in the handout that you'll receive, I believe after this, I link to one of them. I use it's called iStockExchange. It's X-C-H-N-G. It's fantastic. That's where I got 95% of the pictures here. It's royalty-free, and they're really good quality. What were those weapons called in the Kirk versus Spock battle? Okay, I confess, I'm not that good of a Star Trek fan. I don't know what those weapons are called, but somebody please email me the name for next time. Storytelling is bad storytelling is a deadly sin, or lack of storytelling. Every presentation should have a story, I think. So sorry for the confusion there. It was on the slide, but I didn't actually say it out loud. How do you get facts across in a way that's not boring? Well, I think facts are backup. And if you capture people's interest, you can deliver the facts. It's sort of like helping the medicine go down. So if you tell a story, or if you get them involved, or you show an interesting trend, or give them an analogy, I think that's a good way to get into the facts. And you can also follow up with the facts. Again, I would stick to broad-based facts, not getting way down in the weeds. Nervousness, knees shaking. Stage fright is a two-part problem. It's mental and physical. On the mental side, I recommend you prepare as much as possible. And that's one of the deadly sins, is lack of preparation. If you know your stuff backward and forward, you're going to be more poised and confident. On the physical side, I encourage you to stretch, warm up just like you would before exercising. And finally, three deep cleansing breaths before you go up. That will, if you've done yoga, if you've done acting, you know that that will relax you like nothing else. Let me just see a couple more questions. I'm getting this just as we scroll by. We'll have time for more questions in a minute. What makes for a boring story besides digressions or unneeded details? Well, I mean, I think unneeded detail is one of the biggest things. A story that doesn't connect with your audience. But lots of unnecessary detail, like the names of people, minor characters who are not the hero of the story, dates, trivia, things like that. I talk in another presentation on storytelling about your story should be like a tree. You want to start at the base of the trunk and move in a straight line. And the more time you spend out on those limbs, those tangents, will point you toward dead ends and you'll lose your audience. So stick to whatever the main point of your story is. And all those little digressions, the little side notes that we think are amusing, not always quite as amusing to your audience, or they get lost. All right. Let's move on. I want to make sure we get through these sins and also have enough time for the rest of your questions. Thank you. Those are great questions. dull visuals. Sin number six, and we just touched on this. Slides are what's known as visual support, but all too often you see this, where people use their slides as script. And a colleague of mine has a great saying. He says, insert text here is a suggestion, not a command. And PowerPoint's a great tool for organizing your thoughts and putting them in a priority order, but it can really take you in some dangerous territory if you just use it that way. And the odd thing is that we've been shown the way for years. Steve Jobs, twice a year, he would get up and do these keynote presentations, and what you saw were great big pictures, giant headlines, very little text, no bullet points. And, you know, it's surprising, especially with that and TED Talks, that more people persist in this sort of death by PowerPoint scenario. Going back to Seth Godin, I linked to this publication in the handout, but it's called, he wrote something called Really Bad PowerPoint. And among much of the wisdom he said, talking about pollution in Houston, instead of giving me four bullet points of EPA data, why not read the stats, but show me a picture of a bunch of dead birds, some smog, and even a diseased lung. So put pictures up and read stats. Maybe that goes back to answering the question about how you make facts more interesting. And pictures are about more than just giving your audience something nice to look at. They are demonstrably more effective than words alone. There's something called the picture superiority effect. And one study was done that showed when people get information verbally, 3 days later they retain 10% of it. When they get it in picture form or accompanied by a picture, they retain 65%. So think about that. Pictures are over six times stickier than words alone. Going back to an old show business axiom, Robert McKee wrote this great book called Story, and in it he said, it's sort of a Bible for screenwriters. He said, image is our first choice, dialogue the regretful second choice. And we got the question about where to get images. Like I said, iStock Exchange is a good one. Comp Fight is another good one. And I'll cite those in the handout that you're going to get. One of the best sources of great images, though, is your own phone, your own camera. I took this in the neighborhood. I'm always looking out for interesting pictures. Signs, open doorways, open windows, nature, leaves turning. The great thing about using your own photos is that you probably are going to be pretty cooperative about granting yourself permission and not charging yourself a lot of royalties. Video, of course, is another great way to add visual flair. It's especially important when you're doing a speech to bring in outside voices. Colleagues who couldn't be there on stage with you, team members, customers, members of the public, very, very effective. And finally, again, going back to that question about data and facts, this is a bad chart. If you're ever in the position of having to interpret your chart for people, then you might have already lost them. Better to get rid of all the data points, put it in the leave behind, and show trends. Now, this is a tricky one. In my very first show at Second City, it was a student show, the director kept yelling at me during rehearsal. He said, Rob, your energy is flagging. Rob, more energy. Finally, he just, every once in a while, would just scream, energy. And I'm like, what the heck is energy? And I later figured it out. And it is subtle and complex, but it can absolutely make or break your presentation. There's nothing worse than watching a presentation when the speaker themselves isn't really in the game and excited about it. So here are a few things to get your energy up. Warm up physically, just as you might do before a workout. Stretch your muscles, move around, get the blood flowing. And like I said earlier, if you have nerves, three deep cleansing breaths will really center you. Most of us, we neglect our breathing. It's one of the great things I learned from acting is how often I hold my breath during the day. You have to learn to breathe all the time. Here's a trick. Here's a little hack to energy. If you remember nothing else, remember this. Volume, volume, volume. if you're giving a presentation and you're just sort of leaning back and you're talking like you would maybe to a friend at a coffee shop, it's really hard for me as an audience member to get excited for what you're going to say. So you want to give it a little more volume than your everyday speech would be. And for some people, this is a problem. Some people were raised to say, you know, you don't want to be really loud and in people's faces. But if that's you, I encourage you to work on it. Get some vocal coaching, acting lessons, speech coaching, because fair or not, if you're a quiet person and you have trouble speaking up, people will judge you and think maybe you're not confident in what you're saying or that you're meek. So it's really important to work on that. Intention is critical. In acting, they teach us that you have to put intention and meaning behind every word and idea you say. So don't go on autopilot. If you are describing a process, picture the steps in your head. If you're describing a person, visualize them, visualize their face. This is a way to stay connected to the material so you're not just sort of, you know, tuned out. Oh, finally, Ricky Gervais, before he became famous, had this crazy idea for a show called The Office. And he pitched it, and it went on to be, you know, one of the biggest hits of all time. But it was a very unorthodox show. And one of the BBC executives who was in on the pitch that day said, in essence, that it wasn't so much what Ricky Gervais said, but how he said it. He was so full of passion and enthusiasm. He believed so much in this idea that they couldn't help believing in it too. And that's the kind of passion and enthusiasm you have to bring to your presentation, because if you're checked out, your audience is going to tune out. Sin number 8, no interaction. The day of the one-hour, one-sided lecture is pretty much over. Unless you're Colin Powell on the speaking circuit talking to 10,000 people in an arena, most of us, when we go see a speech or a presentation, expect some level of interaction. So you want to build that in. And of course, that's the whole point of giving a presentation, as opposed to just sending an email or a memo, is you have that opportunity for live give and take. And obviously, one of the easiest ways to do this is through Q&A. You should always, if it's technically feasible, reserve time for questions. You should also not fear Q&A. I've worked with some executives. It might be a sensitive issue, and they'll say, let's not take questions here. They might, whatever, ask us a question we can't answer. And again, this is leadership. You have to be prepared to defend your ideas. And so if it's something that you don't know the answer to, you have to be ready to say, I don't know, but I'll get back to you. If it's a sensitive subject, you say, I can't talk about that, and here's why. It's sort of just respecting your audience. And one of the things I like to do, and it works more effectively in a live presentation, is to carry on a dialogue with the audience. I don't always give them the answers. I let them fill in the blanks. So I might say, words are just one way to get our point across. What are some others? Or what is it about exposition that we find so annoying? Exercises, of course, are another good way. I have people act out scenes from movies to demonstrate lessons. I do role-playing, individual and group work, quizzes. I give away candy bars. If there was a way to transport a candy bar to the screen, you'd all get one now. The bottom line is, you want to make your audience a partner in the story you're telling. Getting the home stretch here. Body language is one of the most misunderstood issues there is in all of public speaking. And I'm going to take a little poll here. Marianne explained to you what a little polling thing is. I want to know which is most important, what you say, how you say it, or both. And if you look down, there's four little icons, a smiley face, a cursor, a hand, and a letter, letter A. So go ahead and just sign in. I'll give you a moment to register your thoughts in the poll. We'll look at the results and see what's what. And I'll take another drink of water. Good Chicago water. I see they're tallying up. Now, this is not a trick question. It's not designed to make anybody look foolish. I'm definitely interested in your input. I'm going to let just I'm going to close voting in about 5 seconds. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And I'm going to figure out how to show it. It's right here. Publish responses to whiteboard. Okay. So 63% of you said none. So it looks like B and C are tied. How you say it and both. And really only two people said what you say. That's very interesting. Let me clear the page and move on. Yes, I do. All right. Really interesting. If you've probably heard this figure cited from time to time, that 92% of all communication is nonverbal. Ignore that. It is wrong. It is a flawed conclusion based on the study that was done 4 decades ago, and the study's own authors disavow it. That is not what their study was about. And anybody who tries to tell you a precise percentage like this is crazy. But worse, the trouble with this is it gives people the idea that, well, it doesn't matter what I say, as long as I, you know, just give it the old razzle-dazzle, jazz hands, and I'm out. And I've got my audience right in the palm of my hand. And nothing could be further from the truth. If I was to answer that multiple choice question, I would answer both. Content and delivery go hand in hand. Some other myths about body language is people get very hung up. They tell you, oh, don't ever cross your arms. Don't put your hands in your pockets. There's so many rules. And I want you to forget those too, because something I do in my presentations is I'll cross my arms and I'll say, you know, what does this mean when I cross my arms? And audiences will say, oh, it means you're stubborn, you're closed off, you're defensive. And so then I'll talk for a few minutes, just like this, and I'll say, now, do I seem stubborn and closed off and defensive? I'm crossing my arms. There we go. And they say, well, no. And I'm like, but I've got my arms crossed. How can that be? And they say, well, it's your tone of voice, the expression on your face, the words you're saying, the way you're moving around. And that's the whole point. We are not dummies. We don't judge gestures in isolation. We look at the big picture. So instead of worrying about what you do with your hands, I want you to worry instead, or concern yourself, with intention. If you approach your speech with a positive outlook, if you're confident, if you're happy to be there and eager to share your knowledge and open to the audience, that will come through and your body language will take care of itself. As I like to say, focus your mind and your gestures will follow naturally. Now, does that mean body language is not important at all? No, there are a few things that you do need to attend to. Posture being one of the most important. You want to stand up straight. It helps you project your voice. It helps you project confidence. And if you're in a speech or a presentation, more likely in a small room around a table, you'll probably be sitting. Don't just hang back in your chair like this because the energy will drain out. Sit up straight on the edge of your chair, elbows on the table. That's the way to stay in the game. Plant yourself. Own your space. Don't fidget or shift your weight back and forth. It makes you kind of look like an angsty teenager. If you move around, do so, but do it with intention. Don't just, you know, wander or get all jittery. Eye contact. People cheat with eye contact. I just saw this recently. It was on a boat tour, actually. The guy was very good. He knew a lot, but he never looked us in the eye. You could tell he was always looking at a little space, a little point up in space above our heads. And I think a lot of speakers do that because they're worried about, they feel funny looking people in the eye. And that's just something you've got to get used to. You're with an audience, live. Looking them in the eye is one of the best ways to really connect with them. Plus, if you're looking at them, it's sending you signals about whether they're into the game or not. And if they're feeling positive, if they're smiling, you can use that feedback to feed your own energy. Now, certainly you don't want to be creepy. You don't want to, you know, glom onto one person and stare at them for like 15 seconds. Just a few seconds, move on to another person, a few seconds, eye contact. Very important. The most important thing about body language is I want you to worry less about, my arms, what am I doing with my arms? Focus, like I said, on your audience's body language. If they're slumped back, if they're bored, if they're distracted, if they're talking to each other, if they're buried in their phones, that may mean that you're losing them. And so that is the time to change things up. You might quicken your pace. You might skip to a different section. You might do an exercise, take a poll, ask a question. Whatever you do, don't just keep doing the same thing. That's the definition of insanity, right? Doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. So again, if you're not focused on your audience, and if you're up there, you may not notice this. So be sure to stay tuned in. Pity the poor audience whose speaker decides to just wing it. Nobody wings it, not even the pros. In fact, Nancy Duarte, one of the foremost public speakers and storytellers in the business, she recommends 30 hours of rehearsal for a one-hour speech, if you can imagine that. And I think some executives I've talked to said, I don't want to rehearse this too much. I don't want it to seem too rehearsed, too slick, too produced. And again, I have to argue, as an actor, the more you work your material, the closer you get to it, the more truth and connection you find to it. Actors will spend over 100 hours rehearsing a stage show. And, I'm not saying if you're presenting 3 or 4 times a week, you're not going to be able to give it 30 hours. But if you've got a really big, important speech, practice it out loud, upright, just like you would on stage, over and over and over, as much as you can. Here's a trick. Don't try to memorize. If you memorize your words, then it's going to sound scripted, unless you happen to be a very good actor. What I try to do is internalize. So you take a specific idea, you do it over in your head over and over again, several times, get the gist of it. How you word it may change every time, and that's okay, as long as you get the core idea. Then link that idea to the next one, link those ideas together into sections, link the sections together, and just go over it. When you're in the car, when you're in the shower, when you're working out, when you're walking around, just keep doing it until it becomes almost second nature. Finally, when you get on site, check out the room, get a feel for the space, move around, definitely test out your technology in advance. We don't want to see you trying to figure out which cable goes to the projector. And if you have a chance to run through your speech in the actual venue, especially if it's a giant venue, take advantage of that opportunity. Don't phone it in. Give the speech just as you would with the audience in the room. And most of all, when you're in that last 24 to 48 hours, lock down your content and focus on the performance. I've seen so many executives sabotage their speech by making last-minute changes and additions to their slides, to their content, finding new stories, switching things around. And every time you do that, you just increase the opportunity for errors. Lorne Michaels, producer of Saturday Night Live, had this great saying. He said, "We don't go on the air because we're ready. We go on because it's 11:30. You can make improvements and edits forever. You have to choose and decide it's good enough for now. I'm going to focus on my performance." Finally, the 11th sin. Just as you should open strong, you should finish strong. And so many people don't know how to finish. And what you get is a sort of a trailing off or a very abrupt end. Or they break out something like, "Well, in conclusion," or "all in all, I like to close by saying." Again, you can do better. And also, I'll save this pro tip maybe for the Q&A. Here's how I like to end. I like to end often with a story. You can tell a new story that underscores your main point, or you can go back to a story you told earlier and tell it maybe from a different angle, or give it a postscript. Paint a picture of what the world will look like. What happens if your audience acts now? What if they don't? Imagine a world where, picture yourself 5 years from now. Monday morning, you're at your desk. You have two options. You want to reinforce your main points? If there's one thing I want you to remember, it's this. What I hope you take away from all this is this. The three things to keep in mind are, and finally, a call to action. What do you want them to do? Buy your product, make a contribution, approve your idea, invite you back for more, think or act differently, whatever it is, be explicit. Here's three simple things you can do right now. We need your help. Here's how to contribute. If you like what you heard, there's a lot more in my book. And by the way, before we conclude, if you like what you heard, there's a lot more in my book. And it'll be coming out soon, but you don't have to wait. I put together this guide. It's 7 fatal presentation errors and how to avoid them. And it also gives you 7 smart ways to open your speech as well. It's all about opening your speech, going back to that original deadly sin. And you can get it free if you go to my website. There'll be a link on the handout, but if you're at robbiesenbach.com, there's a little blank right there. You just fill in your email address. You'll get this PDF right away. You'll also get my monthly email, which will give you tips on how to be a more skilled presenter and communicator. And you'll get first word about 11 deadly sins when it's available and how you can get a discount. So, the sins of public speakers, as you can see, are many, but the path to redemption is within your grasp. If 11 sins is a lot for you, I know it's a lot of information, pick 3 things that you're going to do differently. Maybe you're going to find a great story to tell and clean up your visuals and maybe work on opening yourself up more emotionally. Just start small, work on those things, see how they feel, and build from there. I talked earlier about that Navistar conference and how those executives were transformed. I was actually transformed that day as well. This was my first job, actually, in business. Before that, I'd worked in a nonprofit, and I'd worked in government, and I'd worked in an association. And I could always draw a very clear line between what I did on a daily basis and the people we helped. And I was worried that I wouldn't find that same level of fulfillment in business. But I found it there, because seeing those people for the first time in years feeling good about what they do for a living, feeling confident in their leaders, feeling hopeful for the future, that's huge. If you can change someone's whole outlook on what they do that basically constitutes a third of their life, that's huge. And that, to me, is the power of a great speech and the power of communication to really change lives. And that's why I believe the ability to present your ideas in clear and compelling terms is one of the most important skills there is. Now, as you look ahead to your next presentation, you have 2 paths to follow. You can blend in with the crowd and be like everyone else, or you can stand out and try to be different. You can play it safe and stick with the tried and true, or you can be bold and take a risk. You can choose to meet your audience's minimum expectations, or you can choose to surprise and delight them and leave them wanting more. The choice is within your hands. I urge you to go forth and sin no more. And now, we're ready for the last question. I'll just scroll down and see what we got here. What can you do if you read the audience and people seem lost, clueless, or unconnected? Well, I think you just ask them. You say, so is this really connecting with you? Is anybody here confused about this issue? Do I need to clarify this? Because let's get into this. And you may turn your presentation to more of an interactive workshop at that point. Tips for giving presentations over a conference call line. Boy, it's much tougher over a conference call, and it's also tough in a webinar environment. I actually have a whole post on my blog about how to do a webinar, and for webinars and conference call speeches. All of these sins I've talked about, the same sins for those, but everything is like magnified by 10. Visuals are all the more important. Energy is even more important. So when I'm doing a webinar, you know, I try to give it extra energy. I try to increase the pace. I try to make the presentation extra beautiful. Try to tell more stories. It's a really tough thing because you just don't know how your audience is taking it. And that's why I think it's good to have measurement devices to see if people are engaged. And maybe there might be a moderator on the call. I guess you can't do that as much with a conference call, but seeing how many people are on, how many are sticking around, what kind of questions you're getting, if somebody's there to help gauge where things are going so you can get an idea of how things are landing, that would be really helpful. Overcoming the tendency to say over and over. You know, it's funny, I just read an article this morning that said, don't worry about your ums and ahs. See? There are certain people who will teach you that you should never ever say or And that's wrong, because that's what we do in real life. And this article I read today said, when you pause and say it sort of gives extra impetus to that idea. That means it's important, and it's giving people time to warm up to it. Now, if you don't do it a ton, that's why I recommend everybody videotape themselves. If you see yourself doing it a lot, then yeah, try to cut down. But an or an is a natural way that we communicate, and you shouldn't get too hung up about it. Do acting classes really help voice projection? Yeah. Again, in my first show, I didn't know how to project. I was talking all up here in my head, and in order to be heard on the stage, I had to yell. He said, don't yell. And I learned vocal projection techniques, and they will teach you to speak from down in your diaphragm, down here, and to let it out so you're not yelling. And you also, it's a trick, you listen for your echo on the back wall, which is more likely to happen in a theater than an event. But acting classes can definitely teach you that, a basic acting class. Let me see. If you're following a bad presenter, what's the best way to re-engage the audience? Boy, I would rather I'd rather follow a bad presenter than a great presenter. Because, you know, living up to somebody who did something great, if you follow a bad presenter, they are probably just dying for you to be good. So again, that goes back to making sure you have a great opening that with a great story and some emotional impact that just grabs them from the start. I think that's really important.
Hi, Rob, I'm going to jump in here for a moment. We're coming up on 1 o'clock. Rob has agreed to stay online for further questions. So okay. Even though we're coming up on the end of the hour, please stay with us for a few more minutes. So before we get back to Rob, I'd like to thank Rob for this wonderful webinar. It's not easy. There's a potential for a lot of extra scrutiny when you're giving a presentation on how to give good presentations. But obviously, Rob practices what he preaches. So thank you again, Rob. For your very informative presentation. Be sure to visit Rob's website, robbiesenbach.com, and from there you can connect with him, read his blog, join his mailing list. I definitely recommend it. I also want to let you know that the next Friday Forum will take place in 2 weeks on Friday, October 4th, when Amanda Flora returns to Friday Forum to talk about networking. And again, if anyone needs to sign off now, I want to thank you so much. For those of you who joined us today, we appreciate you spending your time with us. As usual, we recorded the webinar, and I'll send a link to the webinar recording in an email later today. And that email will also include a link to the handout that Rob has mentioned. He created a handout specifically for the webinar, so everyone will get that. Also, complete the very brief survey included in that email, if you would. Better yet, do it when the survey comes on your screen and when you exit the webinar. So we do want your feedback. Now we'll get back to Rob for a few more questions. There are a lot coming through, so we'll do our best to fit in what we can.
Okay. Let's see what else we got here. Wahoo, wahoo, wah to you all, too. I'm not going to read every compliment, at least here. I'll do that later. What equipment do you use, camera and microphone, for your presentation? I don't know if you mean for this webinar. I'm on a MacBook Air, and I'm using Apple earbuds to plug in to my computer, camera and microphone for your presentation. But for normal presentations, I use usually whatever equipment they provide. And I don't use a laser pointer usually. One tool I do use is, if you're an Apple person, you can connect, there's an app called Remote. And if you do your presentation, you keynote, you can use this Remote app to control your slides, and it'll even show you your notes. That's where you saw me looking down. I was looking at my phone to check out, like when I was quoting somebody, to make sure I got that right. It's a really cool thing, and people think, wow, that's pretty snazzy. And I do encourage you to have notes up with you. I talk about internalizing, but you can't internalize every possible thing. And if you want to get like a statistic or a quote just right, then it's fine to bring notes up. Just make them unobtrusive. I'm looking for other questions here. Kind of skipping around.
Rob, we've had a couple questions about discovering who your audience is. Like one person asked just recently, yeah, and several like this, if you walk in cold turkey, yeah, how do you discover who your audience is? Do you ask folks to raise their hands in response to a few questions, or how do you discover about your audience when you don't really know the details of your audience?
Wow, interesting. I'd hate to walk in cold turkey, but I guess there are times when you would. At that point, I think I'd first do a good introduction to try to get them into it. And then before I move on to the rest of the speech, after a minute or two, I would talk. So tell me about yourselves. How many of you are X? How long have you been with this organization? Who here is blah, blah? And tell me about, so just get a little bit of that going so you get a better read. You can do it up front, but that can be kind of a tough way to start.
I'll give you another one. Someone asks, so you would advise against giving a summary of the main points you presented in the end because it's not exciting enough? Because I know that's something that people often hear, that's what you're supposed to do, summarize your talk, right?
Oh, no. Oh, absolutely. I didn't mean that to be a sin. That was within the sin, but it was what to do. It's always good to reiterate your main point. Yes. I think if you just conclude, well, thank you very much. All in all, remember blank, blank, and blank, that's not going to be quite as good as if, say, you mix that with a story, a little bit of emotional impact, something personal. I guess that's what I'm saying.
Someone asks, any thoughts on using a chunking speech pattern?
A chunking speech pattern. Is that referring to like the internalizing it? I do recommend that, and just sort of breaking it up into chunks, starting with looking at it on paper, then going away from the paper and just sort of expressing the gist of each idea and chunk in your own words, and then stringing those together. I think other people have some, I think chunking may be a term of art that some use. I think that's the same thing as I'm talking about, is chunking it into sections so it's easier to kind of manage.
Let me just throw two more at you. Someone asks back at the verbal versus visual cues, if it's not 92% versus 8%, what percentage is it? Do you have a percentage for that?
It's actually 71.3%. No, it's not. I have no idea. I think the main point with that is it's absurd to try to ascribe a percentage to it. If I were to say, I'm going to go with 50-50. Maybe 60-40. 60 performance and 40 content. There are certainly speakers out there who can be very captivating, but it's like cotton candy. They don't have much going on there. And I just They may entertain their audience, but I don't think that's the way to go. And there are speakers who are extraordinarily knowledgeable but have no charisma. And those people may do just fine, because if they're an audience like an engineer speaking to fellow engineers, they may be totally into it, and that's fine. So again, it's hard to say, it depends. What I like to say is content and delivery go hand in hand.
I think we'll do one more. Someone asked about using a handout, and I think this applies also with, like, you had, for instance, your Twitter feed. Someone says, if you give a handout, won't they focus on that and not you? What do you think with that?
Yes, they can. What I try to do is make my handouts minimal. And so I wouldn't have a handout with lots and lots of words. I certainly wouldn't have the same words I'm saying, but I might have sin number one, failure to understand your audience, and say, you know, three main points about that. Find out who they are, find out what they want, that kind of thing. So I go back and forth on handouts. Lately, I've been using them for audiences, and they found them really, really useful, because like on this one, I don't really do an agenda slide. I do 11 deadly sins. I think some people like to know where they are in the program. Also, again, it has a link to other information. And it's a challenge to me to make sure I've got their focus, to step up my game.
All right. Thank you so much, Rob. That's all we have time for now. I think we could stay on for quite a while longer. If you have questions for Rob that we did not have a chance to address, please connect with him through his website or blog or Facebook or Twitter. Thank you again from Alumni Career Services here at UVA's Alumni Association. Enjoy your weekend and the start of autumn on Sunday. Be sure to check out our webinar library for any webinars you might have missed, and we'll see you back here in 2 weeks on October 4th.
Thank you, everyone.